the faculty panel is where you get to ask questions to the faculty that you haven't had answered this week. This is the policy and history section. We'll answer questions in here for about 45 minutes, take a 15-minute break. You're free to stay in here or to go upstairs in Wolf Auditorium and see the faculty panel on theory and philosophy, even though this one is much more interesting. We're going to start with the written questions. And if by chance we got a record number of questions here, so I don't think we'll get through all of them, but we'll try. Let's start with a small question here. In all of history, what is the society that has the least replicated of an anarcho-capitalist society or lifestyle?
I mean, there were some typical ones.
But... Oh, is he giving it to me? No, I want to hear. Is this on? Oh, it is. I actually want to hear Bob's thoughts on this, because the other Bob, because the other Bob, this Bob started off like super radical. This Bob started off like radical and then like got more and more. And now he, like, when I look at his Facebook updates every day, I'm embarrassed at how much bolder he is than I am. So I want to hear his thoughts on this. But I mean, when anytime you raise this question, there are sort of some stock examples that you get in response. And I don't mean to disparage these, because there is some merit to them. But you're not really going to find a clear-cut example. But Professor Gerard Casey, whose book Libertarian Anarchy has sold out here, I'm sorry to say, is absolutely insists that Ireland – for 2,000 years did not have an institution that we would identify today as a state. Now, I did an interview with him on YouTube about this. So if you type in Tom Woods Casey, you'll get that video. And this goes on. It's only like, 8 or 10 minutes, and he gives the gist of it. So that's worth looking into. Then there's the classic medieval Iceland example, and I think Roderick has written some on this, and David Friedman has written on it. So you can check that out. And then Tom and others have done some work on, interestingly enough, the American West, the Wild West, is an interesting example, because it flies in the face of what you would think. Because we're told that if we did what you guys say, life would be like the Wild West. Well, yeah, that's true, but not for the reasons they think. Because they think that in the Wild West, of course, it must have been violent because everybody had a gun. And we all know, as soon as somebody has a gun, what does he immediately do? Start shooting people. And yet, it turns out that now the most recent work on the Wild West, it completely revises this. There's a book published by Stanford University Press called The Not-So-Wild West that goes back and actually finds that people actually established fairly reliable dispute resolution mechanisms, and they were able to establish property right delineations and land use and all that without an organized government there in the territory that became California. And that these wild stories about there'd be cases of people who would say, I was shot at X hundred number of times out in the Old West, and then when you press them, they would say, "Well, actually, I wasn't ever shot, or I was shot one time." And it lent the kind of a mystique to the Old West, an excitement, an edge to it. But it turns out that actually the Old West was quite a peaceful place, despite the fact that it had none of the preconditions you would expect a peaceful society to have. A lot of the people who came there were not going to set down roots permanently. You would think that would be necessary. And yet most people wanted to get rich and leave. People came from all over the world. They came from different racial groups. So right away there's the possible ingredients for hostility. And yet even in this type of atmosphere, you actually had a happier outcome than you might otherwise expect.
I think most libertarians have run across these examples, but there is one that was completely new to me when I encountered it, and it relates to an ancient civilization which is known as the Harappan civilization. Harappa was a city and then that city's name was given to an entire region in the Indus Valley of what is now Pakistan. And that Indus Valley was one of the places, like in China, the Yellow River, and in Egypt, the Nile, and in Mesopotamia, the Tigris and the Euphrates. These sort of fertile river areas were the original cradles of civilization. And so this Harappan civilization went back a long way. It started in farther back than 3000 BC, and it flourished for over 1,000 years. And archaeologists have been working on Harappa for about a century now, and they've uncovered a tremendous amount of artifacts, including many building foundations and sort of enough to help them recreate the plans of entire cities and roadways and canals and so forth. And oddly enough, there's, I think, a fair amount of agreement among the archaeologists that none of the artifacts they see in ancient civilizations that had states are to be found in Harappa. And the place I would suggest, if you want to read about this, is an article by Thomas Thompson. Thomas Thompson, that was published in the Independent Review, and I'm losing track of how long ago. It was maybe 6 years ago, give or take a couple. But Thompson's article on Harappan civilization, you can easily find with a web search. And I think it's quite thrilling because this was not a passing phenomenon. It lasted for many centuries, and it definitely appears that nothing like the fortifications and temples and palaces and so on that we associate with the existence and operation of a state are there. And it looks almost as if this was a civilization run by merchants who put their seals on goods to identify ownership, and they had a system of writing and a vast set of commercial relations with the hinterlands. And so it's a very interesting case, and it's very old. So check it out.
Just wanted to add about the Wild West of America. When the U.S. military got there, it acted nothing like John Wayne did in the movies. It was much more like F Troop. The soldiers were corrupt and lazy and drunk, and they tended not to engage in the Indians. They were nothing that you would see portrayed in John Wayne movies of today. Okay, second question. When do you consider the Great Depression to have ended, and how did it end? Got a couple likely candidates for this one.
Well, I date the end of the Great Depression in 1946. And the reason I do that is that it was nearly ended by 1941, but 1941 is an ambiguous year for our measurements of the condition of the economy, because there was already substantial reallocation of resources toward wartime uses in 1941. The military industrial industries were being built up at government expense. People were being drafted in the armed forces in large numbers and so forth. So the ability to determine the condition of the economy as we would in a normal peacetime economy is obscured by those developments in 1941. But then they become totally obscured during the war, because the government undertakes such a takeover of the economy and turns it into a command economy with markets that function, if they function at all, only subject to extraordinary constraints and restrictions and requirements and just a host of state-generated commands that distort everything going on in the economy and direct resources toward wartime uses. So my study of what happened to the level of living of civilians during the war tells me that it deteriorated substantially, that there was no real wartime prosperity, and there was simply a wartime command economy in which guns were definitely substituted for butter, and the amount of butter declined, and of course there was enormous production of guns. But as the demobilization took place, starting late in 1945 and then proceeded very quickly during the following year, there took place the most glorious single year in all of American economic history, 1946. Now, if you go to the Bureau of Economic Analysis website and look at the national income and product accounts, what you'll find is 1946 was the most depressed year ever. Real GDP fell by something like 25%, according to those official data. And that tells you what the data are worth, because you'll never find one shred of testimony from 1946 that bemoans the condition of life, in which people are saying, God, this is awful. There's so much unemployment. We don't have any goods and services available anymore. That is, you won't find the same kind of testimony you'll find in abundance if you look at 1932, 33, 34, because there wasn't any depression. It's just an artifact of the data. But in terms of private GDP, there was an increase of about 30% in one year, far more than in any other year in our history. And so that's when the depression ended. And there's a big story that I tell in my book, Depression, War, and Cold War, about why it ended then. But it's a longer story that brings in the entire period from the mid-1930s to the late 1940s and tries to analyze it all within the same framework in a way that makes sense and helps us understand the transition from depression to post-war prosperity.
I want to add a footnote to that. One, you know, Bob tells a long story about this in his book, Depression, War, and Cold War, which I highly recommend. But one interesting artifact is that the federal government budget in 1945 spending was about $97 billion. By 1947, it was about $35 billion because of the demobilization of the military. So there was roughly a two-thirds reduction in absolute dollars of government spending, sort of Keynesianism in reverse. And I think it's not an accident that 1946 was also the most prosperous year in all of history as far as economic growth. And that certainly has to be one of the factors, I would think.
Yeah, and all the Keynesian economists at the time predicted that they would go right back into double-digit unemployment. Policy question. How can the Fed deleverage its position while holding so many toxic assets like mortgage-backed securities? How can Austrians use this situation in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the first one goes, I think the answer is it can't be done, that they should just, in my opinion, just sell that stuff off. I'm not sure if that's what the person's getting at. And then if you're asking how can we use that, I just sit back and let it blow up in their face and say, well, we told you so. Is that too childish? I don't know. Yeah.
Ben Bernanke said he could do it. Of course, he's leaving.
Let me just say one more serious thing about that is that one of the standard remarks they'll give is they'll say, no, we're fine. You know, his exit strategy is that they said if things ever did get out of control, if the bank, commercial bank, started lending out those excess reserves, we would just increase the interest rate that we pay on excess reserves, right? So that in case you guys probably know this, but the Fed is paying banks to not make loans to people. And so that's a lot of normal crowds are astonished when you tell them that. And so, but even on its own terms, that means if they ever did get into a pickle where, oh, gee, prices are rising and so nominal yields are increasing and so the banks are like, oh, we could, you know, earn 5-6% making normal loans to businesses, and then they had to start increasing the rate at which they're paying interest on excess reserves, that means those things would really start growing exponentially, right? So that's not really an exit strategy. That's like a let's make this get exponentially worse but postpone the day of reckoning strategy. But that's not as snappy.
Is it conceivable that the gross distortions of increasingly centralized market economies cause their own demise in a similar way to that of the USSR when they deviate too far from market forces? The question writer says, I don't see political potential for a move towards more freedom.
I'm not sure what the person's getting at, but like with healthcare, for example, I think the intentional plan is they wanted to ruin the private healthcare market because the stuff they've done, it just doesn't work. You know, I've talked to people, in Nashville, it's like a big in terms of healthcare and health insurance. And you talk to them and they're just astonished saying when this stuff kicks in, I mean, what are we supposed to do? They're making us cover all these people with pre-existing conditions and everyone's going to flip out when we announce the rate increases and we're going to be the bad guys here. And so I think that they knew they couldn't get single payer. That was just going to be politically impossible because all the Tea Party people, you know, old people showing up at meetings and damning them to hell and stuff, like literally. And so nobody likes to be damned to hell in public. So they, I think, then said, okay, fine, well, let's just put this halfway measure in that will make it impossible to stay in business as a private health care insurer, and then the public will come and demand from us 5 years later, we need single payer, and we'll say, oh, twist our arm, you know, we love the Constitution, but we can't allow you guys to die in the streets. So if that's what you're – so I'm saying, yeah, no matter what happens, it's going to be blamed on free market capitalism. I mean, there was some guy floating around Facebook recently about – some guy blaming the anarcho-capitalist GOP, like literally had that phrase. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So, I mean.
Bob gives the federal government a lot more credit than I do. I think some of these people are obtuse enough to believe that they've done something that can be made to work, and they just haven't faced reality yet because they haven't tried to actually make it work, and they've had to delay a number of the provisions already or alter them or exempt particular parties from coverage by the mandate and so forth. And what I expect them to do is when the system is somewhat fully implemented and all the problems begin to hit the fan, to start pecking away at it, trying to fix it piecemeal, failing, and we'll just see the Misesian logic of intervention unfold before our eyes as they put in one fix, it fails, they put in another fix to fix the failure of the fix, and so forth, while the whole system kind of limps along, not doing what it's supposed to, and everybody more or less unhappy with it, but the government continued to say, we're working on it, we're fixing it. I don't really myself think they're smart enough to have concocted a plan to conspire to create this massive system, knowing that it will fail and give them an opening for single-payer nationalization of the whole health system. And another reason I don't think they do that is that some of the private parties, you know, the fascist movers and shakers involved here in the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry and so forth, really are not that keen about a government takeover. They really much prefer fascism, and so they would like to see this fascist scheme work. But, again, who knows? We're going to find out before long, but it's not in the character, I think, of the system that we have that it planned for its own disasters strategically. I think it just blunders into its own disasters for the most part. Now, of course, healthcare is only one of many issues that the question raises, and there are many others, including all these transfers that the government has promised for healthcare, for retirement, for public employee pensions, and on down a long list that has put the government, both national and state and local governments, in a position that's not viable for very long. And so the financial pressures are going to become more and more binding over the next few years. And if they manage to get beyond that, even worse beyond that. So at some point, it seems to me that what we've all been looking for, at least those of us in this room, may actually come to pass. And that is a constraint that they can't laugh off or just talk away or spin out of existence. And that will be the financial constraint. When they find themselves unable to sell government debt anymore because people just won't consider them credit worthy. And when that day comes, it'll be something like the day that came to New Zealand back in the 1980s when they woke up one morning and they could not sell any debt whatsoever. And so they had to change the system very substantially. And I think that day will come, and I really don't see any alternative day that promises the same kind of relief from this continual growth of government that has been occurring now for a century or more in this country.
I'll add a footnote on the health care. What I think is going to happen, if you look at what happened when Canada and England nationalized health care, they did it in a somewhat different way in that you're making it, quote, free to everybody, created an explosion of demand. And, of course, that drove up cost and prices, and that gave rise to pleas for price controls to hold the prices down. And that created massive shortages in the brain drain, so all the British and Canadian doctors came here. So it was all good for Americans. The best and the brightest doctors came here. But what we're doing is making insurance companies incur many billions of additional dollars in expenses because they have to treat pre-existing conditions. And that's going to do the same thing. Costs will skyrocket, and if you're paying $3,000 a year now for insurance, you'll find it'll be $10,000 next year, and there'll be a clamor for price controls. And then the Obamianists will gladly impose price controls, and that'll squeeze out whatever profit exists in the insurance companies, driving them into bankruptcy and creating the entree for the government to take over single-payer health care, which is a euphemism for health care socialism. You know, whenever the single payer is government, it's socialism. And so so I think that's what's more likely to happen.
Just really quickly to reconcile this. So I was saying that they're evil and Bob was saying that they were stupid. And they could be both. You know, I'm moderate. You know.
What is the outlook on this panel, of this panel on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in terms of the Israeli
next
lobby.
Question.
This is an economics conference.
Well, you know, about the financing of sending U.S. aid to Israel.
You've already been attacked, so why don't you take this one?
Attacked? For, well, not on this. Well, I mean, I don't. There's no real budget constraint that prevents the U.S. from continuing to, I mean, no matter what problems the U.S. government has, it can always find money to send to Israel because it's such a tiny sliver of the U.S. government budget. So, I mean, in terms of the financial prospects, I don't think it's likely to change. I think that I think it's just going to continue as it has been for a long time. But, I mean, like, what other sort of thing should I address in this kind of question? It's not a question of the prospects for peace or something? Is it just about the U.S.-Israel relationship?
The conflict in terms of the Israeli lobby and U.S. aid to Israel, aside from finance, what is your personal opinion?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I sort of fluctuated on this question a bit, and I've come to rest on the a pox on both their houses view. Initially, in my early days, I was completely pro-Israel just because I was an unwitting neocon, and that's what the neocon position was. And I read National Review and the New Republic, and they were agreed on this. So I thought, well, if these two magazines are agreed, they must be right. That position must be right. Now, of course, I know better that when National Review and the New Republic agree, you know, run away. So, and but then I went through a period where I thought I was rethinking everything I had believed in the past. So I thought, well, in the past, I was pro-Israel. Therefore, I'm now pro-Palestinian. So now my view sort of is you know, there are people on both sides who, for one reason or another, just do not want to live in peace with people or just will not be reasonable. and that is not by any means confined to one side of this. So my view is that it's nothing to do with any of us, and so I certainly don't want to be taxed to support one side or another or to prop up a friendly police state in the region, in whether it's Egypt or any other place. But I think what we've had up to now is that the U.S. government has been perceived as being such a significant influence in the region in support of Israel that exactly what the U.S. State Department predicted would happen in the late 40s has indeed happened, is that all the enemies of Israel now become the enemies of the United States, countries that were not enemies of the United States in the past. The United States had an excellent reputation in the Middle East all throughout, up through the mid-20th century. It was very friendly. In 1920, the King Crane Commission concluded that in Syria, the Syrians wanted to be governed by the United States as a League of Nations mandate. Can you imagine that? Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. But can you imagine that now? I mean, so when Israel was being created in the late 40s, there were all these State Department protests about what would happen to the position overseas of the United States, and all these were dismissed, and yet it does seem from the point of view of the U.S. that those predictions turned out to be accurate.
And a lot of the actual conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians is because there's not enough free market over there. I mean, the actual conflicts are over water rights. They're over the ability to get certain jobs. It's over land and where you can build your house or where you can't build your house. So a lot of the actual conflicts between individuals over there are the result of artificial government barriers to trade and various other economic activities.
I think I can speak for the panel in saying that if anyone out there wants to open up your checkbook and send some money to the Likud party, we would be the last to stand in your way as far as aid to Israel. But it's none of our business to send any money anywhere. Israel, Mexico, it doesn't matter to me. That should be our position. No entangling alliances with anyone.
How does the radical privatization advocated by some here deal with issues like drugs and medical procedure safety? While the FDA is unquestionably dysfunctional, it is at least some expert authority for consumers to look to.
Now wait. Now we may not like these regulatory agencies, but I don't think we should laugh at somebody's question, right? Because I mean, this could be the first time they're exposed to something like Walter Block saying, "Let's privatize the ocean." Let's let people take one little step at a time. Like St. Augustine said, "Thank goodness people were patient with me when I was a Manichaean. They gave me time to come around." So let's be patient. Now let's hear Bob Higgs's refutation of the whole thing.
Well, first of all, people should understand that the FDA has enforced regulations that have caused more deaths than anything else in American history, perhaps even more deaths than all the wars in which America has been involved. It's not clear because there are many reasons why one can't arrive at a definite, precise measure of how many people have died prematurely because of the FDA, but it is hundreds of thousands of people without question. Now, when I say that, if this were, you know, a room full of New Republic readers, they would probably just run me out of the room or, you know, call security to haul me out screaming. Because strangely enough, even though this agency is lethal in the extreme, if you look at poll results, when Americans are asked how well they like different regulatory agencies, well, of course, they hate the IRS most of all. And then they go down the list. And the one they like best of all is the FDA, the one that has taken more lives than anything else in our history. People have simply been sold a total bill of goods about the protection they receive from the FDA. The FDA is glorious in only one respect, and that is in respect of its command of the Arts of Public Relations. And there, it has no peer. It's been able to convince people that they couldn't possibly do without it, that it's protecting them from all sorts of harms that otherwise would immediately befall them, absent the FDA. It's just all baloney. None of it is true. And if you talk to people who actually are involved in buying and prescribing drugs, physicians, hospital administrators, people who run clinics, and you say, where do you get the information you need to make decisions about, say, drugs and medical equipment? They never say, we get it from the FDA, because, in fact, they don't. Now, very often when libertarians argue for privatizing something, there are many questions raised. People say, but how would it work if we didn't have the government doing X, Y, and Z? In this case, you don't have to worry about that because it already works, essentially by people's ignoring the FDA. The FDA is a police agency. All it does is hold threats of violence, imprisonment, and fine over the heads of people and demand that they obey its idiotic regulations. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't ensure quality. People don't look to it to determine decisions involving quality. And so the idea that the FDA is somehow indispensable is one of the greatest myths that ever afflicted the American people.
So what are you trying to say?
let me just make sure we're not losing anybody, because he didn't really – the logic is it's not that the FDA goes out with a gun and shoots people in the head. It's that – I mean, they may do that. I don't know. But it's that if there's potentially life-saving drugs that the FDA is not going to approve, then people don't get access to them. So the people are considered too stupid to, you know, decide their own treatment, even if they have their doctor who's been, you know, in the field for 30 years saying, I think it's, in this case, warranted, and the patient wants to do it, has been told the risks, and they're doing it in other countries, for example, and they say, let's do it, and the FDA could say no. And so it's like, you know, people who are dying from things where they don't need to die from it. So that's the logic and the sense in which the FDA is killing people. And just in general, I mean, whatever you think the FDA has given us to this point, we wouldn't, you know, lose that knowledge. So going forward, if somebody was saying, oh, gee, but I don't know, you could say, well, the FDA hadn't approved this. So people who wanted to trust the FDA's decisions as a gatekeeper could still know everything up to today and what the FDA's opinion was. And then you could use that if you wanted to. But the point is, if somebody said, you know what, I don't care what the FDA said about that, then they would at least have the freedom to try something else.
One of the first critiques of the FDA I recall running across myself by an economist was some research done in the 1970s by Murray Weidenbaum, who was President Reagan's the chairman of his economic Council of Economic Advisors, and he did one of his books on regulation. He did a study, or he cited some studies on beta blockers. These are medicines that can prevent a second heart attack. And he pointed out how they were available for 10 or 12 years in England before the FDA got around to allowing them here. And so they were able to estimate how many tens of thousands of Americans died of second heart attacks simply because they couldn't have access to beta blockers. And so I think what Bob is referring to is, you know, there are probably thousands of examples just like this of what the FDA does on a routine basis. And also, I know that the French version of the FDA, I remember some years ago, they were in control of the blood supply, and they had the blood supply was tainted with the HIV virus. And so they transmitted the HIV virus to thousands of people because they had a monopoly and control of the French blood supply that went to hospitals and things like that. So there are all sorts of debacles and disasters by these so-called health regulatory agencies, not just here, but the French version, the German version, the Canadian version. So the number of deaths might be many times more than the whole all the deaths of war combined.
There's actually many more ways in which the FDA harms people. This business of delaying potentially life-saving or, you know, very beneficial drugs for anywhere from 10 to 15 years in some cases, while the manufacturers have to pass through an excruciatingly expensive series of tests and at every stage be subject to delays and obstructions by the FDA reviewer, who is often one single person stands between the life and death of thousands of people. But that reviewer is a bureaucrat who will be, as it were, adversely affected if he approves a drug that turns out to be harmful, even to a few people, but not adversely affected if he withholds a drug that would have been beneficial to tens of thousands of people. But the FDA not only hurts people in this way, its regulations just across the board, including its regulations for making an enormous variety of reports of all kinds, its regulations of what are called good manufacturing practices, which regulate in excruciating, stupid detail everything about the manufacturing process of drug makers and medical equipment makers, raises costs enormously. So many goods that might be developed and ultimately, despite the FDA, appear on the market and have very good effects are never developed. This is the unseen of Bastiat in this case. You can imagine, I can imagine, if we didn't have an FDA and we just had a free industry for drugs and medical devices, how those industries would flourish and how many people would benefit. I mean, it boggles the mind to contemplate it. I recall one instance, for example, when Physio Control Corporation, which I knew an enormous amount about, was about to place a new product, a defibrillator, on the market. And just as they were preparing to ship the equipment in the next few days, the FDA stepped in and stopped them. Why? Because in the paperwork, the mountain of paperwork that was required before they could proceed to market with the good, they had omitted to include an engineering drawing of the cardboard box in which the product would be shipped. Think of that. For that reason, they withheld a product that was a life-saving product. These are things that revive people who've had heart attacks in many instances. But they had earlier shut down Physio Corporation for more than a year for violating various restrictions, or so they claimed, but actually shut it down because the public had got hold of some bogus ideas that the products were harming people, and the public loves this. Congressmen love it. They rush in to save us from this terrible mistaken regulation by strengthening the regulation. And so every time there's a scandal about someone harmed by a drug or a medical device, the upshot is that the regulations become even worse and therefore even more harmful.
I did an article on Mises.org recently about the FDA and how the FDA seal of approval actually creates a moral hazard in the sense that if the FDA has approved it, then it must be good for you and there must not be any problems with it. And as a consequence, people are very willing to take all these drugs without question, without really informing themselves of the dangerous side effects and negative consequences of taking these drugs. And almost everything they approve has some potential negative problems for certain populations out there in the United States. And so as a consequence, Americans in particular have been lured into the idea that if you've got a problem, you just take a pill. And so then that effect is, pretty much throughout the American population. The average American, man, woman, and child, and baby, and everybody, takes an average of 13 prescriptions per year, or about over 4 billion prescriptions a year. And many of those prescriptions, there are alternative ways of dealing with things, with ordinary health problems like blood pressure and, things of that nature. So that those drugs aren't necessarily the best way of dealing with health problems, but the FDA seal of approval creates this moral hazard for Americans. Okay, here's a short question. Are there any governments today that do not have central banks?
I know that's where you want to live, Tom.
There are a few countries. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, well, we've decided among ourselves that we think Panama does not have a central bank, and Tom DiLorenzo adds that maybe Somalia, where we libertarians all want to live, may not have one.
There are a number of countries that have what's called, or at least I thought I remembered, currency boards. Thank you, Tom. So I think Panama has a currency board. Hong Kong has a currency board. Argentina had a currency board. And the idea with a currency board is that those countries' currency board only issue domestic currency when they have, for example, enough dollars to back up that currency. So that if the currency board receives, say, a dollar additional money into their holdings, they can issue one Panamanian dollar or five Bahamian dollars, or, you know, if it's in Hong Kong, 6.8 of the local currency. And so the idea is that the increases in the money supply are driven by the government's acquisition of a foreign currency that's supposedly of a more stable value. Of course, hasn't always worked out that way. It certainly didn't work out for Argentina.
Sometimes when students ask this question, I don't know if this person had this in mind, but what they have in mind is, if central banking is such a bad idea, why does everyone have it? I don't know if that person does that, but I've had students ask me that in that context before. But I think the answer to that is that an election is really an election over the right to who gets to plunder the population in a democracy. And once one government discovers a new instrument of plunder, the news quickly spreads to all the other governments of the world that, hey, this is a good gimmick here. We can wring more blood out of the turnip with this thing. And so so that's why just about every country in the world has a central bank. It's been a dandy instrument of plunder for a very long time, to the benefit of the bankers and the people who benefit from it. So I think it has nothing to do with any sort of Chicago school evolutionary theory of competition, where good ideas outlast the bad ideas. Government is always efficient. That was George Stigler's view, by the way, and some of his students, that the democracy is efficient because, of course, it's in the Chicago School view, everything is efficient. That was their view.
Okay, that's the end of round one. We'll take a 15-minute break. Thank you.